And you are listening to Solar Powered Crew FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Inside the Headlines with News Vandal J.P. Sotile. And couldn't be more pleased with the opportunity to speak with J.P., who is our aggregator and culinator, as it were. J.P. does such a great job with putting all those programs together in a timely way. And let's see if we got him on the line. Mr. Sotile, are you there?
Oh, you got me.
Excellent. Well, good to hear your voice. And we've got a lot to cover again. A little bit of the Kaching Dao dynasty, maybe.
Yeah, and a lot of interesting things happening today. We're going to get into it in the week that was. But I'll just tip our hand a little bit here. The Fast Track Authority getting derailed a little bit, a last-minute switcheroo by Nancy Pelosi, even though Obama thought he had kind of sealed the deal, and kind of an interesting thing there. I thought that the media today would be dominated with something of an accidental peep show during the NBA Finals last night when LeBron James was adjusting his shorts prior to the game. It did take over, but the fascinating thing that has just swept through social media and the news media is the interesting case of Rachel Dolezal, an NAACP leader in Spokane, Washington, who turns out to have been faking her blackness for many, many years. Have you heard about this?
I have. So that would be, remember the book, the big famous book from way back, Black Like Me? This would be Black Like Not Me.
Like Not Me. It's really interesting. I think, well, if we put it in a larger context, racial issues have dominated on some level the national conversation now since Ferguson. The officer who killed Tamir Rice in Cleveland looks like he's going to be charged with manslaughter. We've had Baltimore this week. We had a lot of discussion about McKinney and the pool party that went wrong. White folks not really seeming to be happy with the fact that black folks came to swim in their pool, and then the officer resigning after he was pulling around a black female teenager in a bikini by the hair. I mean, it's just we're kind of, you know, I hate to use a pun here based on what I just said. We are swimming through a really deeply seated issue in American life right now. And this is a fascinating aspect of it.
Well, I think one of the corollaries there, too, is that poverty has become less of a something you kind of talk about the crazy uncle in the backwoods. It's become so much more prevalent everywhere that I just think there's some connection there, you know, in terms of empathies and whatnot going out. It's not quite as easy just to retreat to the former positions without more of that coming forth. And we'll be looking at that. But do you know what I mean when I'm saying that?
Well, yeah. And I guess on some level, it seems to me, and this is something I've thought, although I initially was skeptical of it, I actually think that Occupy Wall Street has had a significant impact on American life and American politics. I hate the term, you know, the national conversation, because I'm not sure that we actually have a national conversation. I think we have a bunch of talking heads bloviating and politicians posturing, and then people talk to them to smaller communities that they're involved with on their own. But be that as may, we'll just use the term national conversation. Things have shifted radically, and I think the 1% and the 99% income has in a sense been divorced on some level from race, even though it really can't be completely divorced from race, because obviously blacks and to a slightly lesser extent Hispanics suffer from a disproportionate impact in terms of economic lack of economic opportunity and the impacts of poverty. But I do think that there is this new divide, and maybe class is being divorced from race. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, a little bit. I think also when the pickings are as thin as they are for so many people, we've been reporting, what, two-thirds of millionaires are worried they could lose it all with one crash. 47% of people are $400 surprise accident or issue with having to figure out borrowing money or selling something to cover it. I'm just saying, because it's sort of a bleak economic landscape for a lot. I think a little bit, one begins to appreciate what others are going through dealing with. It's not just like, hey, these lazy bums. It's hard to call certain elements of the population lazy bums when they're working 81, you know, hours a week to get a two-bedroom apartment, barely, because that even continues to go up, as we're seeing with some of the other. I mean, you get the oil prices and gas prices, other things starting to go up a little bit, and it's. I'm just saying, it's a remarkably Greece over there tottering, and the world economy with great article that you brought up in the news today with the story about the ammunition for that governments have and that economic systems are able to use these flooding the market with money, QE, or lowering interest rates, or all these things. Should another recession happen, which actually it's due to happen just by the cycles of capitalism, they may have guns, but there doesn't seem to be any bullets in them.
Well, yeah, that was an excellent article from The Economist about the lack of, as you're saying, latitude for dealing with what is inevitable, because that's how this form of capitalism, and I don't want to just say capitalism in general, because I want to give a nod to our libertarian friends that they would say that this actually isn't capitalism, this isn't free markets, that this is either crony capitalism or a mutated form of capitalism. But we'll just say capitalism as it is prone to these vicissitudes and changes and cyclical rises and cyclical falls. And when the cyclical fall is going to happen, what can they do? In a sense, as you've pointed out, they've shot all the bullets in the chamber, and there's really nowhere to go. And I'm going to pursue this for a second. I know we like to do a little talk back, but I think this is really interesting, because historians tend to associate periods of economic downturn or the beginnings of periods of economic downturn with ethnic strife, with scapegoating. You pick a target, usually immigrant labor force, and you blame them for taking your jobs and for destroying the economy. And one of the things that I think is interesting, there is a fascinating story today on NBC News, of all places, comparing the politics now and the changes in politics now, where all of a sudden you have an uptick in the number of people identifying as liberal. Right. And comparing Obama's reign or Obama's tenure with the revolutionary tenure of Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan came in, he is, in a sense, broke off a huge part, or at least the backbone of the Democratic coalition that was built by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and that would have been white, blue-collar workers. When Reagan was elected, they became the Reagan Democrats, and they merged the Reagan Democrats, people who had been pro-union and pro-Democrat, with rabid social conservatives, with financial elites, and with what would become sort of the neoconservative wing of the party, the sort of the military interventionists. And that has lasted for the better part of two decades. And you can say, well, then what about Bill Clinton? Well, I would say Bill Clinton leveraged Reagan Democrats back into the Democratic Party with his own form of soft Reaganism. And we can maybe talk about it, do a whole show on that sometime. But now you have this switch back where all of a sudden gay marriage, decriminalization or legalization of marijuana, acceptance of interracial couples. I mean, you go down the line, and there has been a lot of Gallup polling on this over the last few weeks, and that's the polling that this article on NBC uses to say we are now on the cusp of an Obama revolution, and this could be the cusp of a generational or multi-generational impact along the lines of the Reagan revolution, I'll finally stop talking here in a second, James, which would kind of match what you're saying, which says that racial scapegoating and ethnic scapegoating at a time of economic downturn doesn't seem to have the traction that it has had in previous downturns. And maybe this is part of this generational shift.
Well, and another way of possibly conceiving of that, and this is, yes, a stretch, folks, in our first few minutes, but maybe it's because the middle class has become the little class, or put another way, it's grown in its lessness, its lack,
right.
That there, that empathy is like, it's not like we're up here and they're down there and they're just lazy. You know, it's more like it's to the point endemically, systemically, where there just aren't enough jobs, and everything that seems to be working is, I mean, there are a few better job numbers right now, granted, but we're seeing that the bulk of the progress, the economic profit seems to be coming still from downsizing, cutting, you know, automating, doing all those things that work with out, you know, work to the advantage of the shareholder and the executives, but like social media itself, not much care to the social fabric, more to what can I grab from this watering hole that I've got potential monetizations operating here. So, okay, yeah, that was a not very good.
No. And I'll just wrap it up in a bow, sure, to say how we began with this, you know, talking about FDR's coalition. FDR's coalition was built during the Great Depression, when an economic collapse became the great equalizer. And yes, we're talking about pre-civil rights. We're talking about still Jim Crow in the South. We're talking about a time, but still, he built a broad-based democratic coalition on the basis that many people were suffering from the folly of the financial elites, because of the folly of the financial elites, and he offered a new deal to them. And that equalization, that was an era of brother, can you spare a dime, which is a much different way of viewing things than Milton Friedman and the Reagan Revolution, which is, brother, I'm going to take your dime and please don't tax it, because I want to put it all in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, right. Don't tax my money I'm taking from you, by God. Anyway, let's get into the week that was, because we have some, free traitors. I love that. Free traitors. Let's jump right in. American Conservative, very interesting publication. They come up with some great piece today from them as well, but about Yemen. Wow.
No, the American Conservative, I'll say this right now, and in this thing, and why don't you just throw the other title out there, because there's a juxtaposition here.
Sure. Why Fast Track Isn't Free Trade.
Now, the Why Fast Track Isn't Free, that's the title of this one. What's the second story?
And the second one is Fast Track to the Corporate Wish List.
Now, here's an interesting thing. We have the American Conservative with Why Fast Track Is Not Free Trade, and then you have the Corporate Wish List Fast Track story, which is from the American Prospect. And the American Prospect is considered a far left publication. The American Conservative was founded by Patrick Buchanan. It's considered a right wing, sometimes called a paleo conservative or a traditional conservative magazine. And they are both on the same page that the key issue here is that these trade agreements, the TTIP, which is the trade agreement with Europe, and the TPP, which is the trade agreement with the Pacific Rim, both of them are not primarily concerned with lowering trade barriers and tariffs. They are primarily concerned with increasing corporate sovereignty at the expense of national sovereignty. That is a fascinating thing. And by the way, the American Conservative is one of the most reliably interesting publications, politically skewed publications out there. And the American Prospect is quite good too for that. Now, with that kind of those two sides of the coin, both thinking the same thing, perhaps it's not surprising that today Obama's big push for TPA, so this is not TTIP or TPP, this is TPA. And what TPA is Trade Promotion Authority. That's usually called Fast Track. It did pass the Senate 62-37, and it actually did pass the House 219-211, but here's the rub. To get it to go to the White House, for Obama to sign it, the House also had to pass TAA. All right, this is a vegetable soup, I know, folks, but that's the TAA is Trade Adjustment Assistance. And what Trade Adjustment Assistance does is it provides funding to mitigate the effects of job losses related to trade agreements. So here's an interesting thing. That that failed 302 to 126. So 302 members of Congress voted against authorizing funding programs to pay for the to help pay off the people, in a sense, to train and do job retraining and mitigate the effects of their job losses related to trade authority. Now, why would the Democrats vote against something that they obviously would want to be a part of, particularly since Obama cut a deal with Nancy Pelosi and the Republican leadership to not cut Medicare to pay for TAA? So you follow me so far here?
Yeah, gotcha.
Okay, so a Pelosi at the last minute before the vote on TAA went on the House floor and said, I think we need to slow down the fast track. I'm voting against it. All of a sudden, Democrats scrambled to change their votes against it, even though this is a program that they wanted, and they got rid of the Medicare cuts to pay for it. Why? Because it was a last-minute revolt. Now, here's the irony. Some of them went back and actually voted for fast track after they voted against TAA, but because TAA and TPA are put together in the Senate version, the fact that TAA didn't pass means it stalls the whole package and it does not go to the White House to be signed. This, to me, is a further example of something that you were just talking about, which is I think there is this growing discomfort with the corporatization of America's future, of the economic system, of the entire political process. You're looking at, TPP, there are some 29 chapters. Only 5 of those chapters relate to tariffs and opening of markets. Much of it remains secret, but a lot of what's in the TPP, and this is according to the American Prospect, are giveaways to the pharmaceutical industry, to software makers, to Hollywood conglomerates. It gives better access of corporations to cheap and unregulated labor in Vietnam and Brunei. It's harmonizing regulations around the world. And what harmonizing regulations around the world does, it's something called ISDS. It's Investor State Dispute Settlement. And what Investor State Dispute Settlement does, and this is wonderfully explained in the American Conservative piece, is that it takes, let's just say, country X says, well, we want to do something about the trade, about people selling cigarettes in our country. And I'm basing this on something that's actually happened in Australia. But if you want to regulate cigarettes in your country, one of the corporations selling cigarettes in your country can challenge a law that you pass, that your parliament or your legislature passes, that your president or your prime minister signs, that becomes the law that the courts uphold. Well, even though it goes through all the tests in your country, a corporation, cigarette maker Y, can then basically sue you with this ISDS process, this Investor State Dispute Settlement process, and go to an arbitrating panel, which is basically it's lawyers who sit on the panel on a rotating basis. And if the arbitrators say, yes, that's right, this regulation impinges upon your profit-making capabilities, we can now force cigarettes into country X in spite of the fact that they've passed laws through due process and their constitutional system regulating cigarettes. That's what this does. It's basically – the way I put it is whenever you hear free trade, just replace free trade with corporate sovereignty, because that's what it has become. And if you want to really get into like the nuts and bolts of it, all of these things are being – negotiated by the United States Trade Representative, that's the USTR, and that is a revolving door between big business, between corporations, and this USTR. Right now it's Michael Froman. He's the U.S. Trade Representative. He's formerly a Citigroup executive. He was chief of staff to Robert Rubin. Of the people who have worked in the USTR office, 144 of them have actually become lobbyists. Mickey Cantor was Bill Clinton's U.S. Trade Representative. He's on the board of Monsanto. He is on the board of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He is a consultant to Morgan Stanley. Then you have Carla Hills. That was George Herbert Walker Bush's trade representative. She is on the board of Gilead, a pharmaceutical company. She is on the board of J.P. Morgan Chase. Both Mickey Cantor and Carla Hills also work for lobbying firms. Folks, I think this is why, James, we're all feeling a little bit creeped out by this, because the one thing that 2008 showed us, and that's the financial crash, is that corporate interests are, in a sense, too big to fail.
Well, it's something that you look at, and from the business point of view, you can kind of break it down and go, well, we just want things to be consistent, because it's hard if we go to this country and it's different for that one. We have to have lawyers and everything. It's really hard. It really slows our ability to move our wonderful products around that people want. But if it's one thing here and one there, we're going to favor this. If we can just make it all the same, consistent, you know, it's like what they talk about for the stock market. They just want things, you want them to know that things are, you know, where they're at and what's coming down the pike.
Predictability, right?
Well, yeah, predictability. Of course, they all make the most money, oddly enough, when the crash, we can see this. We're going to get to that right in a second. But so there's a way that business is not, I don't think business is like evil or something in and of itself. It's just colluded interests with disproportionate pull. It's representing the folks that have the most money, not the most people. And what gets me is when we're a consumer economy and we don't see consumption, when corporations can continue to do so well when they're not really making anything, and is it their responsibility to really take care of the social fabric? You know, not so much according to Ayn Rand and some of those things all should just work out by themselves over time. Long story short on this one, though, JP, is just that it's interesting this being done, I guess, just the brazenness of this being done in secret, rush through. I mean, just think of all these elements. I mean, just to a common person, you can't say what's in the contract, but it has to go really fast. And even though you don't know what it is, you got to give permission to this guy who's going to make all the decisions for everybody else. It's like, are we really talking about this in a serious way? This is like unbelievable. What kind of is it?
Well, and then you look at the allies, and let's juxtapose them. Here we have the American conservative and the American prospect allied on basically the same issues. And then you have Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell aligned with President Obama. And President Obama saying, trust me, you know that I'm all about leveling the playing field. You know that I'm all about making sure that the other countries live up to the standards we hold ourselves by. And that's one of the arguments, Gulp. Which is that if we do this, we can bring them into a world in which they have stronger environmental protections and stronger worker protections. But in the way these things work, James, I know you're laughing.
Well, the logic sort of breaks down if they're going to be like us. I mean, wasn't the whole idea that China opening up to capitalism was going to create democracy flowering and et cetera?
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And this is the big conundrum with Cuba. It's like, well, if we thought that American soft power, that our movies and our Coca-Cola and just the wonderful freedom of being able to choose between at least 13 different types of frozen pizza, or to, you know, the freedom to buy a pizza from Pizza Hut that is the crust is made of 32 hot dogs, that will create freedom. Then you would say, well, then why do we have an embargo against Cuba if what we want Cuba to be is free and what we offer is freedom in the form of capitalism, but we're not giving it to them? I mean, there's that logic too, but the real logic, the Milton Friedman school of logic, the bottom line is the only line. You know, bottom lines and lowest common denominators tend to come together and merge. And really, it's not that they end up getting pulled into America's higher standards. It's that America has to pull itself down to meet the lower cost of doing business in other places. And that happens over and over again.
Well, great. I'm just going to say another quick short aside. I mentioned coming into this about Yemen. I'm just appalled how many weeks into this there's been no all the brouhaha and bravado Saudi Arabia dropping. Now we're seeing cluster bombs and all those things, hundreds dying, hundreds of thousands being moved, an incredible embargo suffocating the population there, and nothing moving much in the direction. And the part of the article that was the most profound is this is no one's talking about it here. Remember how we went on and on and on about no one talking about Iraq and suicide bombs and more dying in a month than the entire history of Israeli suicide bomb stuff there. And nobody was talking about it, of course, till this resurgent thing happened again. But Yemen, I'm just going to say, I want to at least go on record here again, because we usually look at these things. U.S. doesn't want to talk about it, but it's not that simple, not being involved. We are supplying logistics, weapons, and other things. So it's quite, there's a lot going on there, but it's interesting. I guess if that one can just stay completely off the radar for as long as possible, it won't get conflated with Syria and Iraq, maybe, and Libya and so on.
And it's also a way of placating the Saudis at a time in which you're trying to cut a deal with the Iranians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that. Well, they're cutting to the quick. Mr. Kuching, follow the money and influence. You're right. How do you? I mean, even that article pointed at, well, how do you stand up to someone who's on your side when it just shows the, well, complexity. But let's get into the funny money. I just wanted to just say that. AP analysis, Associated Press, more phony numbers in reports as stocks rise. I mean, what's such a bad deal about fuzzy math?
Oh, God. This really is one of the most amazing stories I've read this week. Okay. AP analyzed the S&P 500 and found that 72% of the companies on the S&P 500 and one in five – well, let's start with the 72%. In the first quarter of this year had a significant gap between adjusted profits and net income. So net income is actually the money that you take in. But adjusted profits, which are preferred by analysts, are actually you take the net income and then you just say, well, we had some legal fees and we did some layoffs and we had a failed takeover. It didn't work. We tried to take over. So we're just going to take those things off the books and we're going to call what was a first quarter loss a profit. And analysts say, oh, we like that because, you know, when we go in to sell your stocks, to people, you know, we do our analysis and then Goldman Sachs goes to sell these in sort of either in a fund or they're selling stocks or they're trying to create portfolios. A rising tide lifts all yachts. It's wonderful because wouldn't it be great to do what Boston Scientific did? They make stents and other medical devices. Well, from 2009 to 2014, they had an adjusted profit of $3.6 billion. But that's because they wrote off a failed acquisition. They wrote off restructuring charges. And now I'm just doing air quotes here, folks. Restructuring charges. You just say, well, we're restructuring the business. Sometimes it's layoffs. They actually, whenever they lay off workers, they can write that stuff off of their bottom line. And if you don't, for Boston, in the case of Boston Scientific, if you don't write off the layoffs, the lawsuits, the restructuring charges, the write-offs for a failed acquisition, that period where they reported an adjusted profit of $3.6 billion, they actually had a $4.9 billion loss. So a $4.9 billion loss with a little bit of what you called fuzzy math becomes a $3.6 billion profit. And boy, you've got to imagine that the stock market likes to see a profit instead of a loss. As a matter of fact, over the course of this examination, over the last 5 years, one in five companies had a adjusted profit that was 50% higher than their net income.
Jeez.
And this is, you know, although this is what happened during the dot-com bubble of 2000, and many people said, well, many analysts and whatnot said, yeah, we got to clean up our act, analysts. We're not going to bite on that. No, they're biting on it now. They don't care. Let's go with the adjusted. And by the way, it's all perfectly legal, and it can be the cost of laying off workers. It can be a decline in value of patents. It can be, those lost and intangible assets, whatever those are. How about the value of distributed stock to employees? You can distribute stock to employees and you say, well, you know, what it actually costs, we're going to change that up, and we're just going to make a write-off, and we're going to pump up the value of our profits. Folks, this is what's going on in the stock market.
Crazy, man. Well, how about this next piece? New York Times, states confront wide budget gaps even after years of recovery. You know, I just noticed a short aside that our own city just was downgraded by Moody's. It's still in the category that I think it's called something like, you know, suggested to invest in it, but it's at the very lowest rung right now. Interestingly enough, the towns on either side of us with some kind of an A1 rating, Mount Pleasant and Ottumwa. Just interesting how sometimes these things work. But now you're talking about states with the wide budget gaps, even after years of recovery. What's that about?
Well, and why did JP put these two together? Because this is really about recovery.
Yes.
So if you think about the recovery that we were just talking about, where you have this wonderful recovery for Boston Scientific from a $4.9 billion loss to a $3.6 billion profit, and that goes out on the market, and pharmaceutical stocks and medical and biotech stocks like Boston Scientific have been one of the market leaders. They're right there with the unicorns of Silicon Valley. And folks remember what unicorns are. Those are companies that become IPOs. And before their IPOs, just raising money, they reach $1 billion valuation, or Uber $40 billion valuation, all in prep for going public, and everybody makes out bank. Well, the recovery, which is, they say, 5 to 6 years old, it's, you know, how is it being felt? Well, in Louisiana, it's a $1.6 billion budget gap that they're dealing with. Illinois has a $3 billion budget shortfall. Kansas has a $400 million budget gap. But that's after massive budget gaps already because of Sam Brownback's draconian tax cuts. Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, Republican hopeful, he wants even more tax cuts. He actually cut $541 million out of the budget all last year. He got that tax cut, and they're cutting public schools and universities and health benefits and state parks. All of these things, it's fascinating. If the idea of this is kind of like Reaganomics without the artificial, without the credit card spending. You know, in Reaganomics, there's this thing called the Laffer curve. Arthur Laffer, he actually wrote this thing out literally on a napkin. This is not a joke, folks. And this became the organizing principle of the Reagan administration, which was this idea that if you cut taxes, that extra money in the hands of the people who get the tax cuts, the job creators and the people at the top, will then get cycled into the economy, cause economic growth, and the amount of economic growth caused by the tax cuts will actually be so significant that it will over time increase tax revenue. Now, it didn't work. But see, the hidden thing in the hidden trick – the rabbit hidden in the hat in terms of the Reagan administration was a massive increase in defense spending. And not only did you have the trickle down that didn't come to pass from the tax cut, but you had actual trickle down from public money being flooded into the defense industry, and the people in the defense industry actually went out and spent and drove a consumer side of the economy that turned America into the service economy, because they started to go out and buy services as goods and services were also being offshored and built overseas. So in this case, you have this double whammy of the economy is not really recovering, and these guys have been cutting taxes, and now these states are in dire straits.
Crazy, man. Well, how about Apple making waves again? Second revolution, talking about all manner of stuff, getting rid of folks like us here, DJs, you know, with, and I love the whole logic. You need some human element to the streaming and the automatic grabbing. It just needs to be Apple humans. It's the way they want it, I think. But the Apple of your iTunes, Apple Music, the second revolution. This one is from The Economist.
Yeah. Now, you know, Apple put out the iPod in 2001 and iTunes, and people, you know, the general idea is that after Napster started the free downloading revolution. And by the way, I've never downloaded music for free in my entire life. I go out and pay for it, which is why I have such an insanely large CD collection. And I'm sitting around a massive record collection right now, a lot of vinyl, hundreds and hundreds of records.
Nice.
The idea is that the 99-cent download and the iPod really was the final thing that killed the music business. Video killed the radio star and MTV and all that, and then you had the free downloads. But really, Apple did a number, and The Economist breaks this down. Apple bought Beats. That was Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine's creation. It was a it's kind of a headset that you can actually listen to music on. It kind of eliminates the iPod, and there was also a downloading music and all that. And it just became, they acquired for $3 billion, and now what they're doing, Tim Cook, he is now taking, he's leveraging Beats into Apple Music. It's a new music streaming service, and he says it's going to be revolutionary. And what you do is for $9.99 a month, you can rent music. So, I mean, this is kind of perfect in a way, if you think about it. It's charging a rent to listen to music. He's trying to take on Spotify. Spotify has 20 million subscribers, and Spotify, that's 10 bucks a month. But the difference between Spotify and Apple, as you pointed out, James, and I'd love you to jump in here, is that the music will not be curated by algorithm, but be curated by people. And, Apple has 800 million people with credit cards on file. That's a large potential subscriber base, and the idea is that they're going to be able to crush freemium. That's premium services that have a free service. For a free service, you have to deal with advertising, and then you can pay a premium, which is how Spotify works. But that this is going to, essentially, Apple's going to crush Spotify and the competition. By the way, Apple is under investigation in New York Yep. and Connecticut for colluding with, among others, Universal Music Group to push out Spotify and to pull music off of Spotify. But James, what are your thoughts before I get into the Spotify side of this?
Well, yeah, that's the next part of it. Spotify raising money to take it. Are these apples and oranges? The whole field is so sort of, everything's so different and new, and people are used to this new thing of freemiums. I mean, look at Mark, richest man in the world, almost Zucker, stealing from his buddy and creating this legacy of aggregated watering hole, and then buying out from there. But you see that you give your stuff and then you get harvested. Apple's just trying to slip into, obviously, I mean, just think of you lay out the numbers, JP, and it's like you can just feel the juices flowing in the palate. I mean, if they fell short, there's still a lot of falling upwards, and Apple has done great with iPod and different elements there. This thing of leasing music is an interesting one. It's sort of like what Uber, and we're moving to the point of lease cars. My perspective, when my parents bought their house, they never said they owned it till 30 years after, it was paid for. Till otherwise, you're kind of leasing. Everybody's doing that, right, in a way?
Well, right. That's the rentier economy, which is what's developing with this sort of web, if we can call it even web 3.0 now, where it's all about leveraging extant resources and becoming a middleman. And that's kind of what Apple is doing. That's what Spotify has done. But you could say the same thing. Was radio kind of a middleman? Well, what radio did is you had DJs who were setting agendas all around the country. I mean, you think about the great Alan Freed from Cleveland, who really, which is why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is there, who kind of created rock and roll. Ringo Starr, when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame just a couple weeks ago, said listening to Alan Freed's rebroadcasts coming out of Luxembourg is what changed his life, and how one DJ can actually make a record a hit simply by forcing it. Well, this is sort of the difference between apples and the orange of Spotify, because Spotify does run off of algorithms, and maybe you're sort of having the reemergence of a DJ concept on Apple, which I'm all for. But the ultimate thing is, it's never going to be what it was. And in Spotify's, I guess, defense, they put out some numbers. They have $1.3 billion in revenue last year. They had $197 million loss, but they so far have paid $3 billion out to artists, or at least to artists and record companies and contracts. So royalties have gone out, $3 billion. And here's how it breaks down. There's an interesting piece in Slate. If you are a top 10 artist, you average $7.7 million from Spotify in 2014. And this year, you're projected to get $13.9 million from Spotify. If you're a top 100 artist, you got $1.9 million in 2014, and you're projected to get $3.3 million in this coming year. And hey, look, if really what we've done is or what we've seen is that Napster has been put to rest and free downloading is dying, and somehow, some way, artists are going to get some money, that's all to the better. But I'll tell you, I miss the good old days when you turn on FM radio and you hear something you never heard before.
Yeah, interesting. You're talking about that. There was a hip-hop pirate station that happened that really kind of went underground everywhere. I was just listening to last night with a friend, and it's, you know, some of these things bubble up. But there you go. We have...
Well, go ahead. Look, hey, James, it's all about the music, right?
It is all about the music. We getting crazy. That's right. That is one and only Cheap Trick, folks from my own neck of the woods. Ken Adamatti used to manage a band I was in with the Cheap Trick out of Rockford. We were out of Madison, and that is a cool little tune that guy could sing. My sister used to work at Wisconsin Dells when he was a solo guy, and nailed it on the head. As usual, we're with J.P. Sotile, the News Vandal. You can get on his daily rundown by emailing info@newsvandal.com. As simple as that. Website is newsvandal.com. And JP, let's keep motoring. We got a lot to continue to enjoy here. We're to the Kaching Dynasty. Checking China is what we want to. Let's bust right through it, because some interesting pivots going on here. Geopolitics of American Global Decline. This one from Tom Dispatch.
Yeah, this is a very extensive piece by probably one of the preeminent historians in America today, Alfred McCoy of University of Wisconsin at Madison. Boy, I do like me some Alfred McCoy. He was very influential on me when I was a graduate student reading his stuff. And in this thing, he's talking about how America's, you know, he gets into, you know, a lot of geopolitical theory. A guy from the beginning of the 20th century, Sir Halford Mackinder. And Mackinder, he was at the London School of Economics, and he was a theorist of geopolitics. And his theory was that controlling the Eurasian landmass, it was the central part of the world. We're talking from the Persian Gulf all the way to the China Sea. We're talking about, you know, from Poland all the way down to Vietnam, that huge center, you know, including Russia and Afghanistan. So that's really what it's all about. And guess who is doing the things necessary to control it right now? It's China. Guess who thinks that China doesn't have a chance? Well, it's the foreign policy elites like Joseph Nye Jr. and Henry Kissinger in the United States. They think, oh, come on, China, they don't have the ships, they don't have the weapons, they don't have the Air Force. Well, if you look at Mackinder and what he was saying, he's saying you can't control things on the high seas like the British did for a century or two centuries, really a century, the height of the British Empire, the 19th century. with Navy. The United States has put all its cards in the Air Force, but what is China doing? It's building a massive infrastructure, a new Silk Road, to link up this heart of Asia. Now, I will say this. He does kind of miss a little bit the fact that Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is a who is often in the ear of then-candidate Senator Barack Obama, wrote a book in the 1990s called The Grand Chessboard. And in it, he says the key to controlling the future is the key is really controlling Central Asia, in other words, Afghanistan. And if you wonder why the United States has been as active as it's been in Pakistan and in Afghanistan and now trying to cut a deal with Iran, those places are considered crucial to controlling the Eurasian landmass. Everything else is on the hinterlands. But, you know, as McCoy points out, China is actually doing the hard work of building the pipelines and the high-speed rail lines that can connect. They're basically connecting Beijing with Madrid, and they've got a rail line that connects with Moscow. They got a rail line that connects with Germany. They can move cargo in 25 days from Hamburg to Beijing or to Shanghai in 10 days less than it would take by ship.
Wow, fascinating. By the way, that article, a long one, is really, really an amazing read, just about, you know, the big picture. So it's a great, great piece, I agree, for this week, if you have time to settle into that one. How about amid U.S. paralysis, China ka-chinging?
What's the paralysis? The paralysis is that after 2008, the IMF, the IMF is dominated by the United States, 188 countries. The IMF put a lot of money into the world economy to help buttress the collapsing system, to try and reinforce it. Who pays for the IMF? Mostly, well, since the United States is the largest weighted partner in the IMF and basically has veto power, the United States taxpayer also helps fund the IMF. By the way, the IMF this week, in an incredible story in Huffington Post, being linked through its private lending arm with land grabs around the world and a bloody land conflict with a palm oil producer in Honduras. It's really terrible stuff. But the IMF, you know, there was a thought maybe what we'll do is we'll reform the IMF and give Brazil and China and South Africa and Russia, a greater say in the IMF. And everybody was on board except for the U.S. Congress. And so the U.S. Congress has been 5 years. The IMF reforms have not been agreed to by the U.S. Congress. So China said, okay, we're going to start the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank. Now, 57 countries have signed on, and the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank, looks like it's going to be a big hit. America's telling people, please don't sign up, but everybody's signing up because guess what? China's going to do what the IMF won't.
Interesting, isn't it? Well, that's kind of capitalism in a weird way.
Kind of capitalism.
How China's building a big commercial military empire in the very biggest commercial military empire in history.
And this is, if you match this up with these previous two pieces, this is the nuts and bolts. This is another really long piece. But look, they are building, China is financing or building dams, roads, railroads, natural gas pipelines, ports and airports in places like Samoa, Rio de Janeiro, St. Petersburg, Jakarta, Mombasa, Vanuatu. They're building in the Maldives, an airport in the Maldives. They're building a canal in Thailand. They have a canal proposed for Nicaragua. They've pledged $250 billion of investment in total for South America. So if you think about it this way, the United States has pinned all of its hope on its massive network of military bases and its ability to project military power, which is one of the reasons why Joseph Nye and Henry Kissinger say, oh yes, don't worry, America will always have the ultimate aphrodisiac, that's air power. And the Chinese are saying, okay, you have all your air power and all your air bases, we're actually going to go build things that people use every day that make their lives better, and that would be infrastructure.
Interesting. Infrastructure, that's a word I remember from, was it the 40s or was it the...
Yeah, no, exactly.
World War II, somewhere in there. Anyway, back to China checkmate with China. I don't know, Chinese checkers. Well, the $6.5 trillion China rally that's making stock market history. We went from commercial military, biggest ever. What about this one?
Well, and maybe this is all the money that they're spending, this frenzy of commercial spending, which is talked about in this the Defense One piece written by a Quartz reporter, I think, Steve Levine. is also being, I guess, maybe matched by this massive increase, $6.5 trillion in growth in Chinese stock exchanges in 1 year, and Chinese traders have borrowed $343 billion to invest in the market. So they're borrowing money, investing in the market. Maybe they're a little bit more like us than we thought.
Well, you got that. How about this super rich Chinese head? It's going to be a South Pacific island buying trip. What about this? The super rich heading out to buy islands. Are they going to be making them from the water up? Or no, I don't think that's...
Yeah. These are the ones they don't have to make. And all the way, also, there was an interesting story today in, I think it's called the Arab Business Review, about 33 private islands being built for off the coast of Dubai for wealthy investors. I guess if, you know, no man is an island until they can afford to buy one. And look, the Chinese are doing what rich people do. Guess what? They're a lot like all rich people everywhere. You know, these aren't islands being built like the Spratlys and all that for military purposes. These are people going to Tahiti and Tuvalu and Fiji and buying up islands. And hey, you know, they've actually got an association in Beijing for owners of foreign islands.
Wow. Well, you know what? You ain't nothing if you ain't got a island, that's what I say. Pacific Islanders, speaking of which, try to stop the U.S. military's plan for a simulated war zone. I mean, come on, it's just simulated.
Yeah, and this is the juxtaposition. You see, here you have China going out and building airports in the Maldives and building infrastructure. And what is the United States doing? They're trying to take the Northern Marianas, which is a U.S. territory, along with Guam and Saipan, also the Marshall Islands, a U.S. territory. 1954, the hydrogen bomb, Bikini Atoll. They're still trying to get justice there. The people who live in the Marshall Islands from that test. The United States says, "Oh well, you know, we want to relocate 8,000 Marines and other troops from Okinawa and Guam, and we want to have a permanent war game scenario. Hey, don't worry, it's going to help your economy. People in the Marshall Islands, they're not liking it that much."
Spoil sports. Okay, here's why you should not take U.S.-China hacking tensions too seriously.
Well, look, it's because why? There is this $4 million. Federal employees had their information hacked, according to reports. Well, this guy, S. Kumar, he doesn't have his first name in Fortune, says, well, okay, that's a big deal, but keep in mind, the U.S. imported $466 billion worth of goods from China last year. China imported $124 billion worth of imports. U.S. companies invested $70 billion, like Netflix and Apple. Lloyd Blankfein said, peace is good for Goldman Sachs, so peace with China is good for Goldman Sachs. Ultimately, the money trumps everything.
Ka-ching, the Ka-ching dynasty. Okay, sorry, Obama. America cannot contain China. This from the National Interest, speaking of journals.
Look, this is from Rebecca Lau, and she's written extensively on China. Look, folks, the yellow peril, worry about China. I used to go to congressional hearings when I was in D.C. about China, China this, China that. Ultimately, China's fate and the United States' fate is intimately intertwined, and you can try and contain China, you can try and think that you're the global hegemon, but the reality is, America, there are other people on the block, just you're going to have to play with them.
White China. There you go. That's Ultravox, and that is another great choice from the vault of J.P. Sotili, who I'm still trying to get to do a show here. We may just do it by default, but we're into Motor Zone as well. Interesting news on the trade and trait thing that's happening there. That's kind of fascinating, but I'm just going to reflect on that as we close out here. I'm out of here in a hurry to go play music in Oskaloosa with Sharon Bousquet and Ricochet, but let's get through the week in good news. Quick hits here, folks. Americans still say liberties should trump anti-terrorism.
65% say you should not violate civil liberties to combat terrorism. 30% said terrorism should come first. But only 41% said the government actually violates civil liberties, which may account for why they say, oh, yeah, you shouldn't violate civil liberties, because they don't think it's happening.
Interesting. Abortions down dramatically across blue and red states.
Although there are 267 new restrictions in 31 states against abortions, the 12% decline in abortions is across red and blue states, places where there are new restrictions and where there are not.
Poverty, perhaps. But this is what happens when you scatter 225 cameras around the Serengeti.
You just have to go to this, folks. It's the most beautiful thing I've seen in a long time. Alexandra Swanson decided to put these cameras around. It's been going on for 3 years, 1.2 million images. And it's just, they're Serengeti selfies. They're just some of the most amazing candid photos of any animal you could imagine.
And that's the LA Times. Okay, quick odds and ends. Myth of the garbage patch.
Yeah, Maya Weeks in New Inquiry says, forget about garbage patch. It's not just an island. It's a global disaster that's floating all around the world's oceans. By thinking of it only as a patch in the center of the Pacific, we're trying to contain what is actually a global disaster.
Yes, interesting. What caused the jump, JP, from ape to man?
You got to watch this. This is wonderfully explained. Guess what? It was climate change, folks. It turned out that to deal with a rapid climate change, our human ancestors or predecessors had to get bigger brains to deal with new realities.
How interesting. So it's sort of like the humanist thing. Okay, stop. It's official. Louisiana public schools are using the Book of Genesis in high school science class. Now, we're not talking about the rock group, are we?
No, we're not taught. Yeah, you know, I can't dance. I can't sing. It must be some misunderstanding because I went with that one. Because one school district in Louisiana, in response to Bobby Jindal's desire to have religion right there with science, yes, they are using Genesis in a science class.
Well, it's the Genesis that it is. So how about Texas pool party incident raising questions about wealth and race? We kind of covered that.
Yep. Yeah. Well, the town in question is actually white and affluent, and there's just read this. It's fascinating because black folks swimming in white pools has been a problem for a long, long time.
Wow. My mind is really in a weird place. I was thinking of the old Beatles doing "Black folks swimming in a white man's pool. Take these bro." Okay. So here we go. A Texas pool party. We're through. But did you know that Israelis and Palestinians would gain billions of dollars from peace?
Yeah, a RAND study said $120 billion over 10 years for Israel, $50 billion for Palestinians, including a 36% increase in per capita income for Palestinians. By the way, there's a story Gideon Levy wrote today about a pool incident in the Palestine territories where the IDF came and cleaned out Palestinians so settlers can come swim in the pool.
Wow. Okay, new wave of detentions and disappearances in Gulf, Egypt.
Yeah, and there was a story, didn't make it onto the rundown today, about how from the Egypt Independent about how U.S. military aid to Egypt has continued unabated under the President al-Sisi, and now you have 163 were detained, 66 of them whereabouts unknown. We don't know what happened to them.
Anyway, stepson of Stuxnet stalked Kaspersky for months, tapped Iran nuke talks. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, and this is an ongoing investigation into what happened, how these nuke talks were busted into. It does. A lot of roads are pointing back to Tel Aviv, folks.
Wow. Water wives, men in India marry extra women to fetch them water. What?
Yeah, in one region in western India, where there are 19,000 villages without access to water, women who are widows or single mothers, guys are marrying them and having them walk all day in the hot sun to fetch them water.
What will they think of next? Anyway, enter the Wild West of the embryo adoption industry. That doesn't sound good somehow.
Yeah, no, these are embryos that have been created through in vitro. They're extra embryos that don't get used, and they are, and I'm doing air quotes, adopted by other people, implanted, and children are being birthed from these adopted embryos from other people.
Hmm. All right, our final story. By the way, JP, always great to talk with you. Always deeply appreciating your, you know, your deep dives and your also the way that you organize these things, the way you lay them out with both many other perspectives. It's a great, really a great thing that you've created, and we are very much appreciative of it. Our final story,
much.
You bet. Our final story, Windows on the Sole, S-O-L-E, why we buy shoes we're never going to wear.
Yeah, Jane Schilling, writing in the New Statesman about shoes, pleasure and pain, which is a new exhibit at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. And look, I don't think this is sexist to say women seem to like shoes, right? Shoes are a big deal. And as she writes in this piece, she said shoes are a container for spiritual meaning. Footwear is laden with wishes, both benevolent and malign. Shoes can redeem or they can punish. They can whisk their wearer 7 leagues in a single step, transform a drudge into a princess, summon magical aid, or force her to dance until she begs for her feet to cut off. I know it's all about the shoes for the ladies.
Well, I know it is for me, too. I'm barefoot. There you go. Barefoot and not pregnant. But we'll be back next week. JP Sotile, the News Vandal. This is James Moore. Keep the news on the upside.
Ciao.